Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that if you are unbelievably, bone-crushingly, soul-destroyingly busy, like Emily and I are, I have some suggestions for lessening the load, and they are all in my new book, Buddhism for the Unbelievably Busy, which is available for pre-order now. There are links on our Facebook page and website, but be warned, this isn't a book about coping with unbelievable busyness. It's about making it stop by getting rid of the superfluous stuff and keeping the stuff that nourishes us. Podcasting nourishes me, so let's get on with the show. Please be advised that this podcast contains very graphic descriptions of sexual assault and could be triggering for some listeners.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Narelle Fraser joins us again, and in this episode, she focuses on her time in the Rape Squad and two offenders whose crimes changed the way she lives her life. The offenders became known as the Box Hill Rapist and the Ascot Vale Rapist. And we start our conversation by asking Narelle when she first heard of the Box Hill offender.
I was at the Rape Squad, and we knew that there was a rape of a young Asian woman, what we call a house entry rape. Mm. So that means that somehow the offender has got into the house and it's a house entry, which
so
makes
it's a stranger. Terrifying.
It was in Box Hill, and it was a young Asian woman, and he had bound and gagged her. It was all about power.
Mm-hmm.
Power over the woman.
Mm.
Hence why he would gag her and, put ties around her wrist and her legs. Mm. It was all about power. So the first one, we certainly went and had a look at that because we're the Rape Squad. It's an unknown offender. But as we were looking at the first one, he did it again. Mm. There was another house entry rape.
In the same neighbourhood?
Yes, in Box Hill.
And for listeners, Box Hill is a suburb in eastern Melbourne. How would you describe Box Hill? It's pretty like middle class.
Leafy.
Yes.
Now it's a big Chinese population.
Yes.
I don't know what it was like back.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Big Chinese Asian population.
Mm.
So while we were looking at that first one, we were doing the standard stuff. Like you'd always do door knocks. You'd always speak to the people that knew her. If she caught a bus, you'd speak to the bus driver. Although the CCTV footage, although that wasn't huge back then, but you would do, sex offenders in the area, all that. So when we were looking at that job, the second one came through. And that's when we realised we actually had what we call a serial rapist. So it's not a one-off. It's happened again.
So it must have been pretty soon after, it's a couple of days.
Maybe 5 days at the most.
Wow. Okay.
But it was very, very in quick succession.
Yeah.
So we do what's called victimology. So what we do is the victim, let's go through, they were both Asians. They lived on their own. They had heard noises in the previous couple of weeks.
Oh.
They didn't think anything of it. But we had a little bit of an issue with the language difficulty. We had to have an interpreter. An interpreter is such a necessary part of an investigation, but it just takes away. It's hard to get... It's hard to get that connection when you've got to have an interpreter, a third person.
Yeah.
So it was very, what did he look like? This is what he looked like. You couldn't actually, you could try and say, look, I'm sorry, I know this is difficult, but can I? But when you've got an interpreter saying that, gee, it's difficult.
Yeah.
So we did the victimology, and it was so similar. It was a, you know, unit. It was, say, at the back of the units. Like, there were so many similarities. But also, we found cigarette butts out the front of the, like, outside their bedroom. The cigarette butts were the same. Mm. The same, you know, type of, Benson and Hedges or whatever. One of them had left a back door open for the cat or something. The second one, there was fly wire cut, but they were both bound and gagged exactly the same. He said the same sort of things. I can't remember what it was now, but it was the same sort of thing. If you do what I say, I won't hurt you. And he would say, I'm going to bound your hands, I'm going to do this, do that, but if you go along with me, I will not hurt you. So they did. They were both vaginal rapes. And I think one of them was an instrument which was a little bit different to the other one, but maybe we thought he was just getting a bit more comfortable, a bit more the power was kicking in a bit. We don't know.
It was escalating.
Perhaps. Escalating, yeah. So we believed from the fact that there were cigarette butts and they out the front where they live, at the front of their room, their bedroom, and the fact that there were so many similarities, but we thought, I think we might have a stalker here. Mm. So I think what we did was we asked all the, you know, we got the community's help, and you've got to be very careful because you don't want to create hysteria, but you also need people to keep an eye out for unusual things. So what we asked was if people could contact us, if they heard noises out the front or whatever. Well, we got a bit inundated with all these people that were ringing and saying, oh, I've heard a noise. And sometimes I think people just hear something, oh, my God.
Yeah, totally. It's a, yeah. There's lots of noises around the suburbs at night time.
Yeah, there is. But we started to get quite a lot of information. Anyway, while we were investigating the second one, a third one happened.
Wow. Now, were the victims able to give you any descriptions of
yes.
this?
Yes, okay. And this was the good part. They could give us a description. We knew that he was fair-haired. We knew that he was, tallish, slim, Caucasian.
Caucasian, okay.
And one of them, I think, mentioned that he had bare feet, right? So we're starting to get a little bit of a picture. And then we have a woman that rings and says, I live on a balcony and I reckon I've just heard somebody at my bedroom window. So the boys, because we've got police have saturated the area by this stage. We've got lots and lots of police. So any call,
great.
We, you know, there's police there within minutes. So when this woman rang, we were there within, let's say, 5 minutes, and the boys actually saw a bloke on a bike and they lost him because, I don't know if you – well, Box Hill has got lots of laneways and lots of streets, and so the boys lost him, but they only saw him in the distance because by the time they've gone to the woman and said, you know, what did he look like or whatever, they've lost a couple of minutes, but of course you've got to make sure that she's safe and all that sort of stuff, but they reckon they saw somebody on a bike. And I think looking back, it was somebody with bare feet on a bike. Now, so we're looking at the bare feet was a thing, but we also found cigarette butts. Again, the same type of cigarette, Peter Stuyvesant, whatever it is, but it's the same one again. So we're started. We
on
now,
the balcony or wherever outside her room.
Yep. Wow. But the balcony was like a story up, and all that he had to get up the balcony, he was very, very agile. And there was no steps or nothing. He just climbed up the balustrade and onto the balcony. Mm. So we believe we do door knocks everywhere, every offence you go to, you do a door knock. It is standard. Anyway, we have been there probably 3 weeks by this stage, every day doing, you know, the stuff we need to try and find this bloke. And one day we do a door knock. There's been one of the Asian ladies. Oh, that lady wasn't an Asian, by the way, and
the
that was something.
Victim.
Yeah, that was something. But she was a the stalker. You know where he's up on the balustrade. That wasn't a rape. That was just stalking, right?
All right. So we have three rapes
of Asian women.
Of Asian women.
Yeah. House entry.
And then the lady who phones through and says, "There's someone on my balcony," is Caucasian.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So that was a little bit
askew, different.
Yeah. However, there was a lot of things we thought this might be him.
Mm.
Not yes, but it might be him. And remembering he's barefoot and he's on a bike. We do a door knock. One Friday night, there is another rape. I don't know if this is – this might be the fourth rape. But it's the Friday night that it happened. The Saturday morning, we're out doing door knocks. And we door knock a place – literally over the back from our fourth victim. And it's an old lady. And, you know, we ask, "Oh, who lives here with you?" And she said, "Oh, my husband died, you know, a couple of years ago. My grandson now lives here." And we said, "Oh, could we have a chat to your grandson?" And she said, "I was actually going to get a haircut." This is the conversation. "I was actually going to get a haircut." Hmm. Lives over the back, gone to get a haircut. You're both looking at me, but that's actually a little bit of a tick.
Why?
Why? Well, because he's had a haircut. It's just
like a changing appearance,
yes,
kind of moment. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So it was just a little bit of a tick.
Well, I always wonder this about door knocking, because we were talking to Charlie Bazina about it some weeks ago about the Denyer case, I think, and about, you know, when you're door knocking, you're only really spending moments with every person, surely. So how do you – your instincts have to be so finely honed to know when someone's worth going back to have a look at, when something is worth thinking about a bit more.
I'm not saying you'd go back just because somebody's had a haircut.
Yeah.
However, it is her grandson.
So he's roughly the right age probably.
We didn't know, but we assumed so at that point.
Yeah.
Grandson, you know, you'd think – maybe, well, he's gone to have a haircut on his own.
So he's grown up.
He's grown up. But he also lives immediately behind the rape.
Yep. Okay.
And he's had a haircut. He's trying to change his appearance.
Interesting. Okay.
It's just a little indicator. That's all.
It's worth not going every, back
and don't
to.
Think now everybody that goes to get a haircut, no. Oh, my God. What have they done?
Yeah.
Don't do that.
But this was worth going back to have another look at.
No, this is the first time we've been. Grandma, she's at the door and she's saying he's gone to get a haircut. So you just think he's, And, we've got a
script.
A script, really, of the sort of things we're interested in. And we said, when will your grandson be back? Oh, he'll probably be back about, an hour or so. Does your grandson work? And she goes, oh, no. I don't know what he does all day. He's out and about all day and all night. I can never keep track of him.
Grandma's giving a lot of information.
Tick. Another little tick.
Mm-hmm.
And she said something like, yeah, he's always out and about on that buddy bike. So now we're starting to – it's now starting to be – there's a number of ticks going on here.
Yeah.
Anyway, then one of the boys, while we're talking to the grandma, one of the boys happens to see a bike in the shed. By this stage, this is looking good.
Mm.
Not fantastic, but it's certainly got our interest. One of the, does your grandson smoke? Yes, he smokes. Oh, she didn't know what he smoked, but he smoked. Anyway, she showed us a photo of him. And we're starting to think, anyway, what happens is we decide we're going to go and get a warrant. We're going to apply for a warrant to get the bike. We're going to have a bit of a look around the house, see, if we can find some rope. Because he knows the lady behind that's been raped. She had a very regimented sort of a life.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody has been watching, and you'd think from where he lived, he could see where she went, how, time she put on the lights and all that. Anyway, so we do a, we apply for a warrant, we get it, and we get the bike. He comes back from the haircut with no shoes on. And he was very nervous. Of course you're going to be nervous. That's not a tick, but, you know.
You just, I think police can just make you
nervous. Everyone's nervous around police, yeah.
Yeah, you just have to say hello and some people go to water. It's okay, I won't hurt you. I'm here to help. So by this stage, yeah, so he's come home, we've got the warrant and we're executing it. And he was very cool and gave his name, and I can tell you there's no his name was Joel Cadman. Something had happened with his parents, hence why I was living with his grandma. And we started to find things, like he had the same cigarettes. This is at the warrant when we were taking – it's a 465 warrant, which is evidence-based. We're looking for evidence. So we're looking for rope, the bike, cigarettes, all that. So we get all this. Don't find any – I don't think we find any rope or anything like that. But during the search, Joel and I are sitting at the table and it was lunchtime and I think he must have been hungry or I was or something. And I said, oh, the boys are going up for some lunch. Do you want some McDonald's? Yeah, I'll have some Maccas. No worries. So the boys go up to get the Maccas and Joel and I are sitting there and my sergeant is in another room just going through, you know, looking for stuff. And I said to Joel, how long have you been living with your grandma? He says, I've been living with her a couple of years and tells me, a story about his grandma and why is there something about his parents separating. And I said to him, what's your grandma cook? Like, what's she like to – I don't know why. I was just trying to find some way of connecting with him. He was sort of a reasonable person to have a bit of a connection with. And
because I can imagine some people in that situation would be – very rude to you, to say the least, would be a bit fuck off copper about the whole thing. But this guy is actually trying to be polite and unassuming.
Yes, he was. And we started talking about his grandma and I said, you know, my grandma used to make the best bread and butter pudding I've ever had in my life. And he said to me, my grandma makes bread and butter pudding. And he said she puts... she makes it with raisin toast. And I said, oh, my grandma's never done. Anyway, that is all it needed. And it was like the floodgates opened. And so we started talking about his mum and dad and like he felt clearly it was all he needed and he felt like he could talk to me about anything. It was bizarre. And we've been talking maybe for 10 minutes at this stage. And then he puts his head in his hands on the table and he shakes his head and he says to me, oh, Narelle, I've done it, but what do I do now? And I said, what have you done, Joel? And he says, I've done the rape, so I'm the one you're looking for. I wanted to yell to my sergeant who's in the next room. Sarge, he's just confessing. And I thought, just keep him talking. And, of course, I had to caution him because otherwise it's not worth, you know, anything.
So what do you say in that moment? You have to stop down and say, oh,
Joel, I have to warn you.
Yeah.
I've got to watch and say, I explain what it is. I say, I've got to do what's called caution you. I've got to tell you that you're not obliged to say or do anything. Do you understand that anything is so? I make it in layman's terms so that he understands that whatever he's telling me, I can actually take, you know, say it in court. And he said, I don't care, Narelle. I want to tell somebody. And it was like, come and tell me, Joel.
Yeah. You
know? So I said to him, look, we need to do this back at a police station. Well, by then he sort of – I'm not saying he didn't want to leave my side, but he trusted me. And so
– but you must be shitting yourself on the way back to the station that he's going to recant.
Well, I did because, you know, then the boys get in the car. You're not going to leave a rapist.
No.
A serial rapist with a woman in the back of a car.
No.
You're not going to do it. But the boys – that I have worked with over the years, they are so professional and they could tell, they knew that he was talking to me. So it was just, they just left it to me, thank God, because anything can change that.
The dynamic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like clam up once a male comes into the room or.
And he obviously felt comfortable with me. So we went back to the station. Anyway, in the end, full confessions. He also did a reenactment.
After the break, Narelle talks us through the chilling reenactment by the Box Hill rapist. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Narelle tells us about another offender whose case stays with her. But first, the reenactment that changed Narelle's nighttime routine forever.
You know, it was pretty scary stuff, actually, because what he told me actually had an effect on me. Well, it still does, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But what he would do was he was out every night stalking. So what he would do is he would, and this is what he told us in the reenactment. He went to houses and he'd go, oh, I've done that one there. That late, this is what he'd do. That lady over there, she normally gets home at about 8 o'clock. She has dinner and she goes and reads in bed and she, at the moment, she's reading blah, and she, he could actually tell me the book that she was reading. One girl, he said, yeah, she's got this really pretty little pink nightie that she wears, and all he needed was about, how I'm not good with, like
half
a couple of, not even half an inch.
No, a quarter of an inch.
A quarter of an inch of a curtain open, that's all he needed. Often he would masturbate, watching them in bed or doing whatever. He would have a smoke, as you do.
Yeah.
Sorry. Unnecessary.
Yeah, that's right.
He would have a smoke, bare feet because he didn't want to leave footprints, you know, like shoe prints.
Yeah.
But the amount of people that he could actually tell me, like, that did my head in when he said, oh, she reads this book.
It was like it escalated. So he'd start the peeping Tom stalking and then it.
That is generally what happens. They start, and that's why we will always look for stalking, because generally, I could be generalising a little bit, but my experience is that they start off with cruelty to animals, things like that. Like the other day, I heard about a koala that's had his ears cut off. You know, the first thing I think of, sex offender. Yes. First thing I thought of. Yep. So, but what you say, Emily, is right. So he starts off just watching women and then he gets to masturbating, watching them. And then he gets to the point where he cannot control himself.
And he wants to interact with them.
And he does house entry rapes because he wants that power. And that's what he used to do. He used to tie them up and have this power over them. And but so to this day, not many things, I don't get scared generally. I'm pretty good with that sort of thing. But I must admit, the way this job affected me is now whenever I stay in a motel or somewhere on a ground floor, I will always cross the curtains so that there's not that tiny little bit that anyone can look through. And if ever we get a job about a stalker, if ever I used to, the first thing I'd go and look at is the windowsill by their bedroom.
Yeah, right.
Because often they would ejaculate on the windowsill watching these women. And, you know, the women didn't have any idea. Yeah. They had no idea that somebody was actually outside their window masturbating watching them. Like, that is creepy stuff.
Oh, it's creepy as hell.
Yeah, and it was all gives around, you goosebumps.
Yeah, and he was just going around the neighbourhood, around Box Hill.
Yeah.
So he would have been actually doing the stalking for years, I guess, probably, before he
absolutely
got to.
How old was he, Narelle? Like, what was he like? What was his, I don't know, what was his life situation? He just, was he like a bullied at school? Not that there's any excuses, but what these people like?
He was actually, and this is again, it doesn't sound right, but he was a gentle, unassuming, like I think we all think of rapists as, say, like, you know, big, burly blokes that, you know, big, get down, you know, all this.
Yeah.
you don't think of them often as like almost pathetic. He was a loner. He wanted a girlfriend. He didn't have one. He didn't know how to, like, we found it I thought he was actually quite easy to talk to, but maybe it's a bit different when you look, I don't know what it was, but I think it was power. That's how he got over his loneliness and his this personality trait of feeling like he was a insipid.
Powerlessness from his parents, even maybe separating and ending up with his nan, who knows?
But I suppose I'm not a psychologist, you know, so – but I find that it is often people that are misfits in society that's their way of getting some power.
Also, we learn that sex offenders don't look like sex offenders, because if they looked like sex offenders, they wouldn't be able to offend oftentimes. Right. You know what I mean? If they put us on guard just to look at them, they wouldn't be able to get near people, even though this guy is creeping in through people's windows and whatnot.
What I have learned is that you can never assume because they come in, sex offenders come in all different shapes and sizes, all different personalities. Somebody that you've, you know, grown up with all your life thinking is just the best, you find out that they're a child molester or a pedophile, or you can never, ever judge a person, I don't think. You don't know.
No. And we've talked before about the, like, burden that you and other officers take on in investigating sex crimes, and that's been a big part of your PTSD, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I think I often wonder about this, but I think that I become emotionally – I felt I was responsible. Like with the other girl I was telling you about before, with Simone, with these women that are being, you know, the house entry rapes, what they're doing is they are clinging on to you, putting – like I felt responsible. I felt like I was responsible for this person's safety. I felt responsible for the fact that we couldn't find this person, and like it was that responsibility maybe that I took obviously way too far.
Oh, but how could you not?
Yeah. Like that's the difference with a really good cop is somebody that can distance themselves, whereas I don't think I could distance myself to a point, but I couldn't get away from that. I felt responsible for their safety, and that is a big criteria with PTSD, the hypervigilance and the feeling like you're responsible for everyone's safety, not only your own, but everyone else in the buddy community. And in the end, that starts to, that bottle starts filling. But I did feel it's very difficult to be with these women where they've been belted, you know, and they're just so traumatized, and you think, God, the police are responsible for finding this person to get them off the street so that people like Simone or these ladies, the victims of the house entry rapes, that they can get on with their lives. I found that a huge burden. I mean, I don't think I did at the time. It's funny, but looking back, that's what I think it was, that I felt responsible. The Ascot Vale rapist. It's funny how you never forget their name, Christopher Clarence Hall. And I thought the sort of bizarre thing about this was that I wanted to join the rape squad from maybe, say, a couple of years into the job. For some reason, I was just, and for no other reason, it just interested me. Why does somebody rape someone? All that psychological stuff. And so I was at Broadmeadows in what's called, it was the CPS, Community Policing Squad, way back then. Basically, it's child abuse and sex abuse and sexual assaults. That was my forte. Don't know why, it just was. And out at Broadmeadows, they used to have this arrangement with the rape squad, and that when the rape squad needed somebody to help with a victim to take a statement or something like that, they'd get somebody from Broadmeadows CPS to go in and have a 3-month stint.
Right.
And I put my had in the ring because I'd always wanted to go to the rape squad, and I thought, how good is this? And by this stage, I've been in about 4 years, I suppose, and I'd realised that's where I want to go, the rape squad. I want to be a detective and I want to be at the rape squad. So I put my name down for the 3 month stint. And this is relevant because I finished at work at the CPS on the Friday and I was going to start the Monday. And on the Saturday, I lived in Ascot Vale at the time that this Ascot Vale rapist was just going, you know, he was just offending all the time. And in fact, in the end, he did 20 attacks in 6 months. So it was happening lots, wow, all in and around Ascot Vale, Maribyrnong, Essendon. Anyway, I'm starting on the Monday, but on the Saturday, the day after I finish at CPS, there's a whole lot of commotion around the corner from, literally around the corner from where I lived. And I must have been going for a run or something. Anyway, I see all the guys that I know from the rape squad and I see them all outside this house. So I go up and say, "G'day, what's going on?" And they said, "You don't want to start work now, do you?"
Oh, wow.
And I said, "Absolutely." And they said, "Oh, we've got a little old lady, 92, a little old lady that's been raped. We know it's the Ascot Vale rapist. Would you take a statement from her?" Taking a statement from anybody that has been through a sexual assault is very difficult. It's like me saying to you, "So, Emily, how was sex last night?
Mm.
What position did you do?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have,
It's so much more humiliating, isn't it? It's so much worse. It's like,
absolutely,
it's so intimate and personal and private and humiliating.
Yes.
And
at 92.
And, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, some of these ladies may never have, dare I say, even some women may never even had any contact with men for years,
yeah,
or something.
Oh,
you know?
I would think so. I know she had some sort of contact because she had two kids.
Yeah. She probably had one, the husband who she'd met as a kid and,
had sex with one man. But she had been on her own for a long time. But to actually, and she was, they say, a beautiful old stick. She really was. She was so a lot easier to interview than you would expect.
Wow.
Because she just had such an unbelievable attitude. And, he actually entered her from behind. Mm. Like, this is a 92-year-old. To actually have that conversation with anyone is difficult, but a 92-year-old, he was so humiliating and so degrading. Like, this guy, he raped a 7-month pregnant woman. I think the youngest was 14, but like nuns. He'd gone back and raped one woman 4 times.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the woman had mental health issues.
Oh my God. Wow.
Hence why he has, and she never told anybody because, well, she had lots of issues and she, I don't know if she really understood the gravity of what had happened, the seriousness, but we found out he had been back 4 times to rape her. So this guy had no morals whatsoever. But with this beautiful little old lady, I remember taking that statement. I'll never forget it. And, like, I hadn't even started at that, really. Mm. Looking back, I hadn't even started at the rape squad. But to be honest, this is nothing different to anybody, any other cop that has been in the police force. These are the sort of things that you get exposed to. Mm. And people say, you're so hypervigilant, oh, you're so suspicious. Well, nobody wonder.
Yeah.
Because we actually see it happen. Yeah. We know it happens. It's not like we read it in a book.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you say that she was easy to interview, that's just incredible to
me. Yeah.
She was, do you mean she was sort of quite matter of fact?
Yes, she was.
Emotional about it or?
Oh, well, look, don't get me wrong. It was, she had a couple of tears.
Yeah.
She had a son and a daughter and they were like my mum's age, you know?
Yeah, right.
And they came, just the awkwardness. the difficulty of your mum being raped. Those sort of jobs stick with you. You know, I don't think you can be a caring, like I'm caring, I, you know, generally I love people, but gee, those sort of jobs, they, I've never forgotten her. She was a beautiful woman, but I ended up taking the statement from her. It took a couple of days, but you know, when, you know, she shows you, like, you have to take their clothing, their underwear, you have to get them, well, hopefully they agree to it, but there was nothing that was any trouble to her. I said, look, we're going to have a medical, like this, you know, a medical on a 92-year-old lady. Just really degrading, I suppose. But that's what I mean. She'd go, whatever you need, Narelle, I'll do. You know, she understood.
Yeah.
To catch this man, we had to do this. It's so hard stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was a 6-month spree in the end. How far into the spree are we by the time you come on board? How long has this guy been active?
Oh, probably about 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
But what had happened was, and we couldn't have, I don't believe the rape squad could have done any more than what they were doing. A bit like Box Hill, they were saturating the area, and we had so much help from plainclothes detectives, uniform. We would, the rape squad would be briefing the uniform and the, every day. There was something like 3 briefings a day because we were desperate, because this bloke was like out of control and it was becoming hysterical,
yeah,
like the and you know, justifiably so.
So he's breaking into women's homes,
yes,
at night time.
Yes.
Are there any other similarities? Are they all single women living alone?
No,
all,
it was everything.
It was just everybody.
Everybody, like I said, like a 7-month pregnant woman, a nun, the woman that had mental health issues.
So it's quite risky behaviour really from him too. It feels like he's not.
But he was really, he was very fit. He could run forever. Right. He could jump tall buildings with a single bound, almost like he was really fit. And he was leaving DNA though.
Okay.
He wasn't all that up with the science and how it had progressed. So he was leaving DNA. And that's how we were able to connect a lot of the jobs that maybe may not have been connected initially because they were so different. You know, one was in the middle of the day, one was in the morning, one was at 3 o'clock at night.
This makes it like really hard to investigate, doesn't it? Because, and presumably police were thinking the next thing he does could be a murder. Were you worried about escalation or
Look,
like
I wasn't. Maybe they were, because I was learning to be a detective at this point. So I was working with very seasoned, really switched on detectives that had been in there, done a lot.
Have we got any descriptions of this guy? Has anyone seen him?
Yeah, I think we did.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've got DNA and description.
Yes, however, a DNA doesn't give you a name.
No, yeah, right, yeah.
You know, so but in the end, what happened was that a div van was just driving down Moonee Ponds one night, remembering that we've had 3 briefings a day and we've got a pretty good picture of who we're looking for. Anyway, the div van propped this guy walking along Mount Alexander Road. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and at that point, they were pretty much checking anyone that was out on foot, g'day, just wanting to grab your name or, you know, whatever. Anyway, so they see him and they do a Yui to go and talk to him and he's off. And anyway, they call up. Anyway, they get him. They catch him. They take him back to the rape squad offices and do an interview, but they have nothing on him. Like, our DNA hasn't said it's Christopher Clarence Hall.
No.
Right? So they've got nothing other than he's in Mount Alexander Road, 2 a.m. of the morning, and we don't have anybody that can actually identify him. There was a whole lot of stuff. So what they did was they took a photograph of what he was wearing, a photograph of his shoe, a whole lot of stuff, and they let him go, pending further inquiries, which is pretty standard. Anyway, that following morning, this is at, say, 3 o'clock in the morning, that they've interviewed him and they let him go. And when we all come in, I'll never forget this morning, we all come in 7 o'clock and it was like, what's happened tonight? Like there was always something had happened. And this particular morning, we get told about this the interview. And it's Christopher Clarence Hall and they start to look up his priors. And I think he might have had a couple of cruelty to animals, something like that. Like he fitted the mould. He was the right description. However, when one of the detectives sees a photograph of his shoes, the detective says, that's the description that blah, blah, blah gave us.
Oh, the shoes.
Yep. And they were some, you know, stripy, not added out. I don't know what they were, but that was the exact description. So that's all they needed to say that's. So I remember they did the warrant because we knew that he was living in a boarding house in Carlton. And we'd let him, not, you know, the rape squad had let him go pending further inquiries. But of course, the shoes just confirmed everything. So what they do is they type up the warrant, it gets authorised. And I can remember we went, was in Carlton in, I think it might have been Pelham Street, I'm not sure. But there was a crew up one end of Pelham Street, there was a crew up the other, and we were all in different places in case he did a runner, because this guy can run a mile really quickly. And we knew he'd probably go over fences and all that. So anyway, one of the crew went into the house where he was, and the woman, the boarding lady in charge of the boarding house, she said, oh, Christopher's just left. He's paid me all my bills and he's just left. Like this is like 5 minutes. We've missed him by 5 minutes. No. Anyway, two of the detectives see him walking down the street, like around the corner, and they arrested him.
They got him.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
And he had a ticket. Adelaide or Northern Territory, somewhere like that. But he had his case. Everything he owned was in that case and he was ready. He had a ticket.
Ready to run.
Yep.
So did he confess? How did the interviews go? Really?
Yep. Yep. And he ended up getting, I think it was 34 years and he appealed. He raped, it was 20 women over 6 months and it was something like, oh, how many rapes? Was an enormous amount, say 30, 20, oh, but it was a lot of rape, 25 rapes, I think, counts of rape he got charged with, 56 other offences, like, say, you know, indecent assaults or stalking, and he was a stalker too. And he got 34 years and he appealed.
Don't tell me. What did he get?
32.
And what's his minimum? Do you remember? Like what will he actually serve?
Might be 28 or something like that.
Wow.
Oh, no, it was the best, the highest sentence that had ever been handed down in Victoria. That was, and we called that, or the rape squad called it Operation Century. And in those days you were able to make your own names up.
Okay.
You're not allowed to anymore because a lot of them were a bit sort of an in-joke with the detectives, you know. Yeah. Anyway, this one was called Operation Century because one of the things he did was he made the women count to 100 before they called the police or whatever.
Oh.
So that's why they called it Operation Century.
Wow.
Mm.
Did your 92-year-old victim give evidence in the end? Was she able
to? No, they weren't required to give evidence because he.
Oh, because of course he confessed.
Yeah, yeah. I know that he didn't have a good upbringing. I believe that he was abused as a child. It wasn't that good. But some, as I've said before, some people it's learned behaviour. They don't know any different. Well, they know what's right and wrong, but they've learned a certain pattern of behaving. And
with offenders like him, when they are released from jail, they would get pretty closely monitored, wouldn't they? They are on the sex offenders register. You'd have to appeal.
He'll be on for life.
You know, turn up at the police station however many times a week.
Well, he would have, he would be on parole, I would imagine, and parole would monitor him, you'd hope so, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, again, though, I don't think there's really the resources that we
no.
like to think there are. We like to think yeah. there's a person per person ratio yeah, of right. monitoring, you know, and I don't think that's the case. Mm.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. Thank you to Narelle Fraser, and thank you to everyone who's given us nice reviews on iTunes and everywhere else you get your podcasts.